This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The award-winning film Gravity is set in outer space and opens as Dr. Ryan Stone, played by Sandra Bullock, is struck by flying debris from a Russian satellite. Here's a clip from the movie's trailer.
Explorer's been hit. Explorer, do you read? Explorer, over. Explorer. Astronaut is off structure.
What do I do?
Dr. Stone is off structure.
What do I do?
Dr. Stone, detach. Must detach. Don't detach. That arm's going to carry you too far. Listen to my voice. You need to focus. I'm losing visual of you. In 3 seconds, I won't be able to track you. You need to detach. I can't do you anymore. Do it now.
Well, that's a big-budget 3D version of what could happen if an astronaut or a space vehicle got hit by flying debris. Orbiting trash and space junk are a growing and real concern here on Earth. Debris removal ideas have been floated using things like nets and harpoons. The Pentagon could be awarding a contract soon to build a space fence that would track and warn of falling space junk. We have two guests who have joined us in this hour of Radio Times. And here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Lisa Ruth Rand. She's a space and environmental historian. In fact, she's a doctoral candidate at the University of Pennsylvania, getting a doctorate in the history of science. She's also a Guggenheim Fellow at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. And Lisa Ruth Rand, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you here. And joining us from Boston is Jonathan McDowell. He's an astrophysicist at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, a historian of the space program, and the author of the Internet newsletter, Jonathan's Space Report. And Jonathan McDowell, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Very nice to be here, Marty.
I wanted to begin with that that scene from Gravity, and I was doing a little bit of research in preparation for the show. I'll put this first to you, Ruth. Lisa, which is this is something called the Kessler syndrome. We were listening to what was happening in Gravity. I think many people saw it, so they know what those sounds were all about. But what is the Kessler syndrome?
So the Kessler syndrome was a hypothesis put forth in 1978 by someone named Donald Kessler that suggested that by the time the new millennium rolled around, we would see the first collisions happening in outer space, and possibly that might lead to what's called cascading collisions, which is what we saw in Gravity. Now, a lot of people have noted that the scenario presented in Gravity was physically impossible, right, that a cascading collision would not necessarily happen within the matter of minutes, but what's shown in Gravity is still something that could happen, though it would unfold over a much longer period of time. So part of Donald Kessler's prediction did come true in that in 2009, we did see the very first catastrophic on-orbit collision between two spacecraft, a functioning American Iridium communication satellite and a non-functioning Russian satellite. And that created two very large plumes of debris that still threaten functioning spacecraft today. Wow. And every so often in the news, you'll hear about the International Space Station needing to maneuver to avoid a piece of junk, either from that event or from other catastrophic events on orbit.
Because this junk is orbiting the Earth.
Yes, it's orbiting the Earth, and it's orbiting so quickly that even a very small piece of debris can have a catastrophic impact on a large spacecraft. NASA uses an analogy that a piece of debris smaller than an inch around traveling at about 6 miles per second in orbit would hit as hard as a bowling ball at 300 miles per hour.
Ouch.
So yes, that could completely destroy a spacecraft, whether it's a robotic spacecraft or a spacecraft with people in it. It still could be very catastrophic.
Jonathan, do we know how much stuff, trash, junk, whatever you want to call it, debris, is orbiting the Earth?
Yes, we at least know about the larger pieces. And at the moment, there are about 16,000 pieces of stuff in orbit around the Earth that our radars and cameras are tracking, of which only about 1,000 are working satellites and the rest is junk. And so in addition to that, you know, our radars can only see stuff above a certain size, above about 10 centimeters, a few inches. And there may be much more smaller stuff that's still big enough to cause damage, as Lisa explained. So really keeping that air traffic control of what's out there and keeping track of it is just a first step in making safe a space place to operate.
And when you use the words larger and smaller, can you define your terms for us, Jonathan?
Right. So we have, I mean, the things to really worry about are like the event that happened that Lisa mentioned in 2009, which was two satellites that were of order a ton that hit each other. And that creates an enormous amount of debris. But even a small piece and the small ones that we can track, say, are a few inches across. And as you said, those can cause a lot of damage. Even something as small as an inch across that would be too small to see, you wouldn't want that going. If you're an astronaut, I wouldn't want that going through me at 18,000 miles an hour.
Indeed. And what's the chance of this stuff falling to Earth, Lisa?
Well, every object that's in orbit will fall to Earth eventually. That's just a fact of gravity. Now, whether that takes weeks, months, years, centuries, millennia, it depends on how high up those objects are. So what was portrayed in Gravity was objects mainly in a low Earth orbit. So that's orbits that are within about 1,000 miles above the Earth. Mm-hmm. And those objects are subject to kind of an interesting self-cleaning mechanism that the Earth's atmosphere has. Now, space is often understood as something that's dead or empty. It's a vacuum. But space actually has an ecosystem. It's one that's not biological, but it's one that still shows interacting forces of gravity, of radiation, of energy. And the Earth's atmosphere expands and contracts, and that expansion and contraction often is tied to the solar cycle. So the sun sends out more energy or less energy depending where it is on this 11-year cycle. So when the Earth's atmosphere expands, it creates friction and can drag some objects that are lower in lower orbits back to Earth. And most of those objects are destroyed by that incredible heat and friction. Some do not. There have been plenty of instances where objects have re-entered and remained largely intact, the most famous of which was Skylab re-entering in 1979. Pieces of it survived and landed over parts of Western Australia, and a local government famously fined NASA $400 for littering, which was the only real outcome of that particular re-entry event. But every object will re-enter. It's just a matter of whether or not it's large enough to survive and where it falls.
And can we, does this trace back, Jonathan, to the beginning of the space program, whether it's in the United States or other countries that have been sending stuff into outer space?
Yes, and of course, you know, the first satellite was launched in 1957, Sputnik 1. And throughout the 1960s, there were typically only a couple of dozen working satellites in orbit. And the space junk problem wasn't too much of a danger, although there was a nasty incident right at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis when a Russian attempt to launch a Mars probe exploded in orbit, and American radar suddenly saw a large number of debris pieces heading over the pole. So that was a little nervous making. But
indeed,
it was really only in the 70s that people started to be really aware of the debris problem. We started to get rocket stages. You know, when you launch them, they have a little fuel left over. And after a few years in orbit, the components of that fuel can get together and explode and generate a lot of debris. And we started to take measures to avoid that sort of in the early 80s. And one of the big changes, I think, that's happened now is that most satellites now in low orbit have engines, which wasn't true 20, 30 years ago. And so they can, there's at least a possibility that they can dodge this debris.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I'm sorry. Did you want to add something more to that, Jonathan?
Yeah. So whereas older spacecraft, like, for example, famously the Hubble Space Telescope, don't have those engines, and they're at the mercy of gravity and the atmosphere.
Wow.
And so what that means is, because most satellites now do have the capability to dodge, it's worth putting things like this space fence in place, putting warning systems in place, so that satellite operators can be alerted in time if we see that a collision is imminent. And of course, in time is a critical thing, and we're learning how to do it quickly.
Well, and which is an interesting thing to think about. I mean, you can think about driving on the highway, how quickly you have to respond to something. Is that true in space as well, Jonathan?
Not really. If you're at a reasonable height above the Earth's atmosphere, so say maybe a few hundred miles up where the space station is,
right,
you can, you know, if all you have to worry about is gravity, you can predict where you're going to be weeks, months in advance with beautiful precision. Where things mess up is the Earth's atmosphere. Even at the height of the space station, there's a tiny amount of atmosphere. And if you're barreling through it at 18,000 miles an hour, if you imagine, you know, sticking your head out the car window at 18,000 miles an hour, you're going to get quite a headwind.
Yes, indeed. And lose your head, but yes.
And so even in the very thin atmosphere of low Earth orbit, that has an effect. And as the sun flares, as Lisa mentioned, the Earth's atmosphere gets more dense. It changes from day to day in ways that you can't quite predict. And that introduces an uncertainty into where a low orbit satellite is going to be a few days or a few weeks in advance. So you can really predict reliably only a couple days ahead because you don't know what the sun's going to do. You don't know what the Earth's atmosphere is going to do. There's actually weather in space, it turns out. Who knew?
So
that's the amount of time you have to plan, and you have to plan how long do you have to fire your rocket engine. If you fire your rocket engine in a certain way, that puts you in a new orbit. Is that new orbit going to go near any other debris? Is it going to let you carry on doing the mission you want to do? And so it takes some time, like maybe a few hours or a day, to set that up. And so you really need that couple of days warning.
Let me get back to you. Lisa, it looks like you wanted to add something to what Jonathan was saying.
I did. Jonathan, forgive me for being a historian here, but I just wanted to pick up on something that you mentioned, that that we only became aware in the 70s of the debris problem. And that's something that's actually, you touched on a pretty common misconception that I found among space policymakers particularly. In my research, I've been exploring a much earlier consciousness of outer space as an environment at risk. And in fact, I would argue that different communities were aware of space debris as a problem as early as the very first years of the space age. So a good example of this was a project that's been largely forgotten by most Americans, but was in the news quite a bit at the time. The Air Force in the late 50s and early 1960s built a space communications project called Project Westford.
Westford, yes,
you've heard of Westford. So just
I
for
know
those,
the guy who did it, actually.
I'm looking forward to speaking with him, hopefully, in the near future. I spoke to one of his graduate students, and he gave me some good insight. But this project, for those who are not aware of it, it established an orbiting ring of very, very tiny copper fibers or dipoles in an orbit around Earth. And it was used as a scatter medium for radio communications. So a signal sent from the ground would be scattered by these hundreds of millions of copper dipoles in space, and a large enough receiver on the ground could pick them up. Now, the Air Force saw this as a really excellent use of outer space for communications. It was cheap, very important even then, and it would be resilient to nuclear attack. So at this time, the Soviet Union and the United States were both exploding bombs in space. Talk about space debris.
Sure.
They were exploding bombs in outer space, creating new radiation fields, disrupting existing radio communication systems. It was a bad scene. So Westford provided a resilient form of communications in that kind of scenario. Now, there was quite a bit of protest against Westford, particularly by optical and radio astronomers across the world, who saw each of these copper fibers as part of a larger body of space debris that could... They didn't call it space debris at the time. They called it contamination. They called it pollution. But what they were concerned about was their ability to continue to observe the cosmos.
Hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break. That's Lisa Ruth Rand, who joins us along with Jonathan McDowell. We are talking about space junk, space debris. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from the new Wells Fargo Propel World American Express card, designed to bring the world within reach for Wells Fargo customers. Details at a local Philadelphia area branch or wellsfargo.com/propel. Wells Fargo, the world is open. Keep exploring.
This week in This American Life, Zara was in a car wreck and went into a coma with a traumatic brain injury. And when she came to, she had trouble remembering the years before her accident. Big stuff, like divorcing her husband.
The doctors said you don't want to create any more trauma with her, and so if she's indicating that she thinks that she's still married, you can't just drop that bomb on her.
That's this week,
tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Washington, D.C. native James Tillman originally wanted to be an accountant but ended up in music instead.
Closing both my eyes, shutting out the world.
We'll hear about Tillman and other artists on the DJ Sessions next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Join WHYY June 26th for the third annual Best of the Chefs. You vote to crown the winners at a two-hour tasting featuring an array of local restaurants and businesses. Tickets and more information at whyy.org/events.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Jonathan McDowell and Lisa Ruth Rand about space junk orbiting the Earth at thousands of miles an hour. The growing amount of debris has raised some concerns about how to clean it up or how to avoid collisions. After all, we depend on space technology for things like communication and for energy and for transportation. Jonathan McDowell is an astrophysicist at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. Lisa Ruth Rand is a space and environmental historian, a Guggenheim Fellow at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. Lines open if any questions or comments, and that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Lisa, you want to finish your story? That music kind of interrupted the delivery. Go ahead.
It's a great story, and I don't mind telling it over and over again. So just to wrap up that story, I was talking about Project Westford and the response of optical and radio astronomers to that project, which the Air Force saw as critical communications infrastructure, but which astronomers saw as space debris. And I argued that this is one of the earliest instances of concern about space debris, because even though these were tiny little copper fibers in space far enough away that very few people could actually see them with the naked eye, it still presented problems to astronomers, both with their practices at the time of being able to look at from the ground, but they were also considering building the first space telescopes at this time. So the hazard of space debris that we understand today, of a collision hazard, was something that even in the early 1960s, astronomers were raising as an issue that should be considered when determining what should be sent out into space.
So, Jonathan, one person's debris could be another person's, you know, cutting-edge technology.
Right, but there's another point here I think that Lisa's touching on, which is really great. The concern about Westford was mostly about the communications issues, how it would interfere with communications, and not about the collision risk. And I think until very, very recently, the issue of space debris as a collision risk in space has been seen within the aerospace industry as sort of a separate thing. And what Lisa's really good comments are bringing home is that it really is situated in a bigger issue of space environmentalism. How do our activities in space affect the natural environment of space, as with the starfish nuclear test that she referred to, the communications environment of space, like Westford, and the risk from collisions? They're all part of this bigger issue, and I think that realization is only really now starting to gel among the aerospace community.
Well, and the question being, I mean, who is if something is debris circling the Earth, who is responsible for what, cleaning it up, Jonathan McDowell?
Right, and in fact, one of the very early pieces of space law was a treaty on a convention on who's responsible if space junk falls on your territory out of the sky and does damage. And so there's this concept of the launching state, which was worked really well in the days of when it was just the U.S. and the Soviet Union doing things. But now in this globalized era, it actually becomes quite hard to determine who the launching state is for a particular satellite. And it's actually, I think, the space law regime may be in a little bit of an overhaul, need of overhaul in that respect.
Let me just, and this is to you, Lisa, which is, I mean, I'm trying to imagine a world without satellites, for instance. I mean, we depend on satellites for communication, for commerce, for energy, I guess predicting weather, navigation. The military uses the space, scientific research, all so much of our modern day life is dependent on things up in space working.
Absolutely. In fact, I was glad that you played that clip from Gravity, but to me, one of the most compelling parts of that movie happened a little before that scene, wherein the astronaut played by George Clooney hears that all the satellites are gone, and his immediate comment is, well, there goes Facebook for half of North America. And that statement actually made me sit up and take notice, because I thought, you know, given my research, I'm watching what's happening in space and thinking, what's going on at the ground right now? We've just suddenly lost, within the space of minutes, every single satellite in orbit around the planet. And to me, the main drama of that scenario would be taking place on the ground.
Right. Living without satellites,
without a chance to recuperate and come up with new ground-based ways to replace those services. I mean, I think that that most Americans really don't think on a daily basis how much we use satellites. The irony, of course, of that statement about Facebook is that most Facebook users using their computers would probably not be impacted right away. But everything else, from using an ATM, to using your cell phone, to being on a commercial flight, to using an advanced weather report, any number of services that you don't think about as being satellite-enabled are tied to that infrastructure, that information infrastructure that we have in space.
And do you think, Jonathan McDowell, that we're at a sort of, if not a crisis point, at least an intersection where we have to think more seriously about what we send up into space, how to I guess manage it, monitor it, and what to do with it if it falls apart or gets hit by another object?
Right. I think there's been an increasing awareness among the space community that you've got to take this seriously. The first moves, the first thing people were worried about was the geostationary orbit where those television satellites, those communication satellites are, because that was already starting to get crowded in the 80s, and they instituted rules that said, well, you've got to carry a little extra fuel so that when you're done with your satellite, you move it out of that orbit and it doesn't clutter it. And that was really the first step towards doing better in the space environment. And then we started having rules like, well, even though it's cheaper to blow your lens cap off with little explosive bolts, put it on a hinge so it doesn't add another piece of space junk. When you have a little fuel left over on your rocket engine, fire it again to lower the dead rocket stage to a lower orbit so it'll re-enter quickly and won't be as much junky. And so slowly the norms of space conduct have been evolving to be a little more responsible. But of course, as usual with human activity in the environment, it's a little bit of too little too late.
Well, are we talking about pollution then, Lisa? Is that a word we should use when describing or talking about space junk?
Well, pollution is a complicated word. What's
it
pollution
is.
To some is not pollution to others. And I think... this is something that we saw in our, space is commonly referred to as the final frontier. And I think we saw a lot of this in the Western frontier in the 19th century as well. This is something that it's all a matter of interpretation of who's seeing the object in space. I mean, I think that, Jonathan was referring to these, empty rocket bodies and lens caps. These are all things that don't necessarily serve a purpose. So the United Nations Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space defines space debris as all man-made objects, including fragments and elements thereof, in Earth orbit or re-entering the atmosphere that are non-functional. But what does it mean to be functioning?
Yeah.
And here I'd like to use another anecdote,
which is
in 1957, when the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, about 4% of Americans reported seeing Sputnik crossing overhead. But what they didn't realize was that most of them were actually not seeing Sputnik itself, but the rocket body that had sent it aloft. And the Soviet rocket engineers did this on purpose because they knew even though that Sputnik was polished to a high shine, it would be invisible to the naked eye or to binoculars, what normal everyday citizens would be using. So they outfitted the rocket body with reflective prisms to make it larger and shinier so that someone on the ground might be able to see it transiting overhead as a small point of light crossing through the night sky. Now, one could argue that that was the first piece of space junk because its intended purpose to deliver Sputnik into orbit was over. However, it still served a very important political purpose, that is, inspiring fear or pride in the hearts of everyday citizens on the ground, depending on your political affiliations. So pollution is a very loaded political term, but it's one that that I think requires a little more thought about who is actually using that term and what it's describing.
What do you think, Jonathan?
I think that's fair, but nevertheless, there are a lot of there's a lot of stuff in Earth orbit that everyone agrees is not providing a useful purpose. There are about 6,000 metric tons of stuff being tracked in Earth orbit, and maybe 1,000 tons of that is actually working spacecraft or things that people care about. So there's a real problem here, a problem that everyone agrees on, and really it's economics, I think. Is when does the danger to commercial satellite operators start to exceed the cost of adding extra fuel, extra precautions to remove the junk?
And I'm assuming the more things you send up there, the more you're going to have potential collisions or traffic jams or debris, yes?
Only up to a point, because, the norms have changed. And nowadays, if you're NASA, for example, and you're launching a satellite, you're required to provide to NASA headquarters a plan for not polluting Earth orbit. You've got to say, well, okay, our rocket stage is going to be deorbited immediately after launch. Our satellite, when it finishes operating, will make sure it has enough fuel to lower its orbit so it'll re-enter in only a couple of years. And so the new satellites that are going up from the big space agencies are taking precautions to greatly reduce the pollution. The main problem now is the existing satellites and accidental collisions. Mm-hmm. You talked about the Kessler syndrome at the beginning of the program, and by some models, that chain reaction, even though it's going to take 50 years to actually double, it's already underway.
And that's Jonathan McDowell. He's an astrophysicist at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, a historian of the space program, author of the internet newsletter Jonathan's Space Report. Also with us, Lisa Ruth Rand, and she's a space and environmental historian, a doctoral candidate at the University of Pennsylvania on the history of science, and she's a Guggenheim Fellow at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. And we are talking about the problem of space litter, space junk, and we want to hear from you. Any questions or comments, lines open at 1-888-477-9499, and you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Jonathan, if I can go back to you, just you mentioned the word space fence, and the little bit of reading that I did in preparation for the show, it looks like the Pentagon is at least contemplating a contract for a space fence. How would that work?
Right. Well, and there was an older space fence that was recently retired. The idea is that you want to track the objects in orbit. You do that in two ways, with radar and with telescopes. For most of the low orbit space junk, you want to use radar. And if you don't know, to follow a satellite that you already know is there, that's relatively easy. You point where you think it's going to be. You check it's there. But for new debris that you don't know about, you have to have some kind of tripwire that says, oh, we've got something new. So the space fence sends up a beam of radar energy that bounces back to Earth, and if it hits anything along the way. And so satellites coming over in the old space fence was along the southern United States, and satellites coming from the South Pole toward the north would pass through this radar energy, reflect radar energy back to the Earth, and so be detected. Mm. The new one, I believe, is going to be out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean in the Marshall Islands, but it'll serve very much the same purpose.
Lisa, you want to add to that?
Oh, sure. So the old space fence that Jonathan spoke about was shut down in September 2013, and that was due to the squeeze of sequestration.
Really?
Sequestration? Yes, yes. That was the cause that was stated by the Air Force in shutting it down.
Interesting.
And the next generation space fence has not yet been awarded. And as you mentioned, there are two large aerospace companies that are working out the final details on proposals. And in many ways, it will improve. So right now, we're not blind. I guess is the reassuring statement is that the Air Force is
we know something about what's happening.
Well, they've been able to distribute a lot of the work that the old space fence did to other detectors. But that said, the new space fence will still be essential, and it will improve upon our abilities to view much smaller pieces of debris. So the new system, when it goes online, will use what's called S-band radar, which uses a shorter wavelength and can pick up objects much smaller than the old space fence. And in many ways, this is accommodating the realities of our new space regime. I mean, the old space fence was built, the old space surveillance system was built under a Cold War reality, something, the main purpose of these facilities are to keep an eye out on what's going on in space, primarily, to see what other people are doing in space, right? So it's less about space junk and more about missile detection and things like that. So by being able to see much smaller objects, the Air Force is adapting to the new realities of operating in space.
Jonathan, it sounds like you want to add something. Go ahead.
Yeah, and the one of the things that's happened over the past 10 years is the advent of what are called CubeSats, small satellites built by universities that are only a few inches across, less than a pound in weight, that are much harder for the current systems to keep track of. And last month, some folks had a Kickstarter-funded satellite that contained 100 tiny satellites weighing only a few grams, less than an inch across, that were going to be ejected from this little satellite. It actually didn't work. The timer didn't work, and it re-entered before its little sub-satellites were ejected. But if we start getting these tiny satellites, the current tracking systems just are completely incapable of dealing with them. So there's been a real change in the use of space, a democratization in which many more players have come in the game. It's no longer a superpower game. It's individual university engineering departments across the world who are building these small satellites and getting cheap rides for them. But it also means that the tracking problem is very much harder than it used to be. So we really need, desperately need, an improvement to our space tracking capability.
So, Lisa, can anyone send anything into space? I mean, if we're talking about Kickstarter campaigns.
That's actually a really good idea. Jonathan, do you have thoughts on that?
Well, you know, there is regulation, right? If you're going to launch a rocket, that has to be regulated by the launching state, by the country. But in practice, and if you want to send radio signals, that's very tightly regulated because you don't want to be interfering with someone else's satellite. But just the launching, it's actually pretty much a free-for-all in reality. And if you have, you know, $100,000 and you have a bunch of cheap labor in the form of engineering undergraduates, you can...
at some university somewhere, right?
Right, exactly. You can... it's not too hard to put together a satellite. In the 10 years between 2003 and 2013, 100 of these small CubeSats were launched. Yeah. In the following year, between 2013 and 2014, another 100 were launched. And so this has really taken off. It's getting, for people like me who try and make lists of all the satellites, it's getting to be really hard work.
Well, and with the fence, it sounds from your description, Lisa, that it's really just, it's just tracking things. It's trying to keep track of what is out there, so to speak.
Yes. I think the word fence might be a little misleading.
Yeah, because I see fence as sort of like Star Wars, you know, the sort of alleged Star Wars was going to protect us from some kind of attack.
Right. And I mean, the idea of a fence is keeping something out or keeping something else in.
Right.
And in many ways, that's not what it's doing. It's just giving, it's knowledge is power. It lets us know what's going on up there to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. There's no way we'll ever know everything that's happening in space, or at least I believe there's no way we'll ever know, and there's no way for other people to know what we're doing. And I think that's the way it is now, and I think that especially the U.S. military would like to keep it that way. It makes a lot of sense. So it allows us to have a better understanding of what we're dealing with, of what the space environment looks like, about what's moving through our general vicinity. But it's not doing anything to, you know, to
harpoon this stuff back.
Right.
Or
right. It helps us have an idea of, for instance, also when objects are going to reenter to some extent. I mean, a lot of times it's hard, especially with a dead satellite, there's no maneuverability. Mm-hmm. Data from something like the space fence can allow us to have some idea of where it might fall, which allows people on the ground to prepare. Usually objects fall over the ocean or unpopulated areas, but it's still good to have some idea of where these objects might be going.
Well, we have to take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about space junk flying around the Earth. And again, that's Lisa Ruth Rand, a space and environmental historian, a Guggenheim Fellow at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. She's here with us in Philadelphia. Jonathan McDowell joining us from a studio up in Boston. He's an astrophysicist at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. And we are talking about what to do and how to track and how to monitor space junk. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Questions or comments, give us a call. We'll be right back.
The Pulse tells stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
This is my health. We're not just a body, we're not just a head.
Robots are really just computers with motors.
The speed at which they can process information, their ability to filter out.
In addition to your knee pain, you're also dealing with insomnia.
The Pulse, Friday morning at 9 on WHYY.
The Cannes Film Festival, the most important international film festival, concluded over the weekend. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about some of the films that won awards and that incited the deepest disagreements with our critic at large, John Powers, who was at Cannes. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Not a pop quiz, but a festival for science.
I want scientists to talk in plain language with clarity so that we all have a leg up on these very difficult subjects that really rule our lives now.
Alan Alda on fusing entertainment and science without diluting the main ingredients. The World Science Festival next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about junk flying around in space, things as big as defunct satellites to small chips of paint. There's a growing concern that all this orbiting trash could be a threat to space missions and could damage space instruments critical for our communication and transportation, energy, even military networks. And that's what we're talking about with our guests, Lisa Ruth Rand and Jonathan McDowell. You can send us an email with any questions or comments, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Lisa and I were talking about during the break, and I'll include you in on this conversation, Jonathan, having to do with things like space nets, the idea of perhaps using a net to perhaps drag some of this debris back into Earth's atmosphere. Lisa?
So there's been a lot of different ideas for how we might actually remove debris, and none of them have actually been implemented yet, to the best of my knowledge. And when you speak of nets, that is actually one idea that's come up from a Japanese company using these ancient fishing net technologies to create a very large magnetized net that could capture objects in space and drag them back down to Earth. Another popular idea is coming out of the Swiss. They're developing something called Clean Space One, which is a satellite that can attach to another object in orbit and drag it back into the atmosphere, thereby destroying it. But it's pretty well acknowledged that this is a complicated situation, the idea of debris removal versus debris mitigation, which is what Jonathan was talking about, the idea of creating less debris, thereby lessening the problem. Active debris removal of actually going up and taking things down poses a major liability issue. So if you're
about who's responsible?
Exactly. Well, who's responsible, but also when one country is going up and taking down another country's satellite, even if it's a dead satellite, that's still something that could cause some political problems for either side. So this isn't something that's easy or that will require a lot of political negotiations for that to take place.
So, Jonathan, is it possible to even think about, you know, somehow vacuuming some of that debris or trash that's in space, in outer space?
I think so. And I'm a little skeptical of the nets, or there's also people suggesting, you know, zapping the smaller pieces of debris with lasers. But if you actually do the calculations on this dreaded Kessler syndrome and see what the biggest threat is, I think the biggest threat is from the larger objects, because they're the ones where if they hit something like the Cosmos Iridium collision a couple years ago, they create the serious amounts of debris. And so there, an approach that involves this going up and bringing them back down is practical. It's starting really to be practical. The for example, the U.S. military organization DARPA is funding a project to go up to satellites in geostationary orbit and salvage parts off them and things like that. So I think the regulatory issues, the legal issues that Lisa mentioned, are tractable. That the pressure to solve them and the will to solve them will be there, and we will start to see in the next 10 years the beginnings of space trash trucks that go around and start removing and deorbiting the larger pieces of debris.
You startled when you said trash trucks. Go ahead, Lisa.
Well, I love that you used that term, because something that's really interesting is that the space shuttle actually was intended to be a kind of a space truck. That was a space garbage truck. That was one of its intended early purposes before it got way too expensive to be used for that purpose. So the space shuttle initially was thought of as something that would be cheap enough to launch many, many, many times a year, way more times a year than what we saw with the actual reality of the program. And there are schematics that show it going up into space, retrieving a satellite from orbit and bringing it back down to Earth.
Wow.
Now, in reality, this only happened a handful of times. I want to say maybe two or three times that they actually retrieved a satellite from orbit and brought it back intact. So this is an idea that's been a long time in the making. It's just a matter of whether or not it's going to be implemented. And obviously, the space shuttle isn't going to be the one to do it. But perhaps some sort of a robotic spacecraft could, you know, could serve that same purpose.
I do want to get to our callers, Jonathan. But should people on Earth be concerned about being bonked on the head by space junk?
Well, I don't think so. There haven't really been any casualties in the 50 years of the space age so far. Most of the Earth is ocean. Most of the time, re-entering space debris melts in the upper atmosphere. It's only the larger, denser pieces that make it to the surface, and the chance of it hitting any one person is pretty infinitesimal. There are a lot bigger things to worry about than pieces of space junk falling on your head.
You agree with that, Lisa?
I do, although there's more to falling space debris than just hitting a person. So there are other environmental impacts. For instance, in Cosmos 954, a defunct Russian satellite had a nuclear reactor on board, and it reentered in 1978 over a remote part of Canada and spread a huge radioactive debris field over. It was uninhabited, but it still required quite a bit of cleanup. And the Canadian government, this is the only time that the so-called liability convention of the UN Outer Space Treaty was ever invoked. The Canadian government sued for the Soviet Union to help with the cleanup, and the Soviet Union actually argued, well, this is not our satellite anymore. It turned into something else when it reentered and became space junk. Now, in the end, they did end up paying out quite a bit of money, but that just kind of speaks again to these liability issues that come with space junk versus spacecraft.
Because there aren't the borders. I mean, we're talking about moving objects, and we're not talking about countries that sort of own pieces of space, at least not yet.
They own moving things moving through a vacuum rather than distinct pieces of real estate. So it's very complicated.
It is very complicated. Let me get to Jared from Mount Airy to join our conversation. Hi, Jared. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Oh, that's the perfect background for our conversation. Go ahead, Jared.
Sorry about that. I live in a corner.
Fair enough.
I had a question about unidentifiable space debris.
Mm-hmm.
I've read a couple of articles through Time and a couple of space journals where they said that some of these objects are large enough to be considered satellites, but non-man-made, and also they might be fragments of asteroids that have passed through. So I just want to know, is there any historical evidence or reference to any of these?
Well, Jared, let me see if Jonathan McDowell can answer your question. Jonathan, can you?
Yes, I think the answer to that is no. We're pretty confident that none of the tracked space debris has sort of mysterious origins, because there are a few pieces where we don't know which launch they belong to. But if you look at the angle of their orbits to the equator, they're very characteristic, for example, of stuff launched from Cape Canaveral that always goes into a particular angle orbit. Mm-hmm. And so we know, okay, this obviously belongs to some rocket launched from Florida, but we don't know which one. Because the effects of atmospheric friction change the orbits over years, and it's hard to work back the orbit. So I'm pretty confident that within the orbit of the moon, we don't see extraterrestrial objects, either natural, pieces of asteroid or UFOs. But as you get beyond the moon, that becomes more interesting, and it's certainly possible that little asteroids that are orbiting in orbits similar to that of the Earth get temporarily captured by the Earth-Moon system and hang out in deep Earth space for a while and then pop off again in an orbit around the sun. We've actually seen that happen several times.
Oh, that's interesting. Jared, thanks for the call. Looks like you want to add something, Lisa?
Thanks, Jared, for this call. I think you seem to be mentioning natural objects as well, so meteors and near-Earth objects that transit close to the Earth. Now, I think what Jonathan said fit that pretty well and addressed that part of your question, but I also wanted to note that I think there was an interesting turning point in 1988 where there's plenty of naturally occurring objects in orbit around the planet, in space, near Earth. But in 1988, we crossed a threshold where the amount of objects in orbit around the planet, in these lower orbits within the moon's orbit, there were more objects that were human-made than objects that were natural. So now the objects, most of what we're looking at in orbit around the Earth that are threats to our satellites are human-made and not naturally occurring.
Good to know. Jared, thanks for the call. Let me see what Peter from Cranberry, New Jersey has to say. Hi, Peter. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Two great shows today. Thank you
so much. You're welcome.
I worked in aerospace for 36 years, helping to develop weather and communication, navigation satellites, and interplanetary satellites. So I wanted to ask your guests if they could talk about the relative risks as a function of altitude, that is, the difference in risk at, a space station altitude versus a GPS system altitude or weather satellite altitudes. And then lastly, the commercial communication satellites at geosynchronous at 23,000 miles. The risk is a function of the altitude.
That's a great question. Peter, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Jonathan, I heard you, do you want to take it from there? And then we'll toss it to Lisa.
Sure. Absolutely. The worst place to be is in polar orbit a few hundred miles up where the space station is and a little higher where the Hubble Space Telescope is. Most of the satellites in low orbit are going over the poles, and all the orbits in different directions cross over the North and South Poles. So it's not a coincidence that the big collision in 2009 happened there. As you get higher, there are many fewer satellites a few thousand miles up because of the strength of the radiation belts. The Van Allen belts makes it more expensive to build a satellite that can survive up there. And so when you get up to GPS, really there's the GPS satellites and the Russian clone of that, which is called GLONASS, but there's not really too much other stuff at that altitude, and so the collision risks are pretty low, and things get really thin beyond that, with the single major exception of the geostationary orbit. There's this magic orbit, 23,000 miles, 35,786 kilometers above the surface of the Earth, where if you send a satellite in orbit at that height, it takes exactly 24 hours to go around the Earth as the Earth spins beneath it, and it seems to stay above one point. And that's super valuable real estate. That's where they put all the communication satellites, because then you can just put your dish out on your balcony and it has to point in one direction. You don't have to move it. So loads of satellites go to that very specific place, and it's really, you know, their average heights are within a mile of that magic value. And so it's very crowded, relatively speaking, and there the collision risks are significant. But in some ways, it's not as bad as low orbit, because also the speeds are lower around there. In a low orbit, you're going at 18,000 miles an hour around the Earth, so collisions are pretty bad. Whereas in the high geostationary orbit, it's about five times slower, something like that.
Peter, thanks for the call. We have an email from Jeff. I'll put this to you, Lisa. Couldn't a small piece of metal, even the size of a grain of sand, wreak havoc if it hit, say, the space station? Would it?
A grain of sand is very, very small.
Even if it's metal, right?
It's very, very small. That said, there have been studies put out that have looked at very thin metal projectiles and their impacts on large spacecraft, and even very, very tiny objects, even made out of paint. We have evidence that the space shuttle Challenger actually won one of its missions. Came back with multiple impacts going through the panes of their windows. So the space shuttle windows had multiple panes, and even these tiny little microscopic objects were creating impact craters.
Wow.
And we see there are holes in parts of the Hubble spacecraft as well, especially there's a really wonderful exhibit that just came up at the National Air and Space Museum that displays artifacts taken during the last repair mission in 2009 that shows the impact of the small debris environment in space. Now, it's a little exaggerated because those impacts were sampled, but still it shows that even small objects can have a pretty major impact when they're moving that quickly. So, yes.
Did you want to add something to that, Jonathan?
Well, sure. Just to say that the the damage it would do, right, make a hole maybe in the space station, a small piece, as opposed to completely pulverize it, which a larger collision might do.
Right.
And we have had some pretty bad collisions, even low-velocity collisions. The one that comes to mind here is when the Russians had a bad parking job on one of their cargo ships and managed to smash it into the Mir space station. And the NASA astronaut on board at the time said, "You know what? When you're on a space station and your ears pop and you hear a loud hissing sound, that's really not a good thing."
That's when you say biting your wrists in absolute abject fear. Yes,
yeah.
Indeed.
So that kind of thing you could imagine happening, and the astronauts are trained on what to do in that situation. Whereas I think the risk of a gravity-style scenario where you totally smash up the space station is much lower.
About a minute and a half before I have to say goodbye, Lisa, if I can just toss this to you. So looking ahead, I mean, what kind of either technology or legal or scientific safeguards have to be put into place, do you think?
Well, there's been what's called a space code of conduct kind of batted around in the international space community, and whether or not that's going to take hold. Jonathan did speak about some of the regulations that are in place for, you know, that new spacecraft have to be registered, and they have to have certain safeguards in place in order to not, you know, dirty up orbit more than it already is. But I think it's going to require, because space is an internationally used environment, it's something that we're all going to have to start to cooperate on putting together some standards of sustainable activity in space in order to reduce this problem and not make it worse.
Final word to you, Jonathan McDowell.
Yeah, no, I think Lisa's absolutely right. I think we're entering, you know, a challenging phase where space junk is a real problem, but also the willingness to do something to tackle it, both in the regulatory and engineering ways, is starting to be there. So I'm optimistic in the long run.
Well, we always like to end on an optimistic note. Jonathan McDowell, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's an astrophysicist at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. He's also the author of an internet newsletter called Jonathan's Space Report. Lisa Ruth Rand, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she's a space and environmental historian, a doctoral candidate at the University of Pennsylvania, and a Guggenheim Fellow at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, a very cool museum, if I can add. For more information about Radio Times, go to whyy.org/radio. Times. You can leave a comment. You can check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and of course, download a podcast of the show. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, and Emily Bryant, with Sophie Reed helping us out today. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for those phone calls as well.